once more under the breach, dear friends. Else fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. Jake's not here. He's off visiting wife relatives in, or some relatives and friends in the Denver area. He seems to have a tremendous propensity to go this time of year to places where it's colder than it is here, which is not something I enjoy doing. So anyway, the telephone numbers, if you'd like to give us a call in here, give me a call in here at The Personal Wealth Coach. And ask questions or make comments about anything to do with the economy, investing, or things of that ilk. 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. Again, that's 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Or a telephone long distance is kind of going out of style. I don't know on your phone if it is in mine, but it's a toll free to you number 1-866-597-1400. Lord knows we can all us old folks can remember when long distance meant something, and today you just use your phone and you call wherever you want to call, and we don't worry about long distance toll fees. It's a wonderful world that we live in. Little disclosure here, the Personal Wealth Coach is not just a radio program. Ta-da! Personal Wealth Coach is also an investment advisory firm. We do wealth management, and we're in Salado, Texas, and our regulator is the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, and that's my disclosure. We have a call on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you give us a layman's explanation of what's going on with the Russian ruble? I'll hang up on this.
All right. What's going on with the Russian ruble? It's in free fall. Layman's does. As a matter of fact, that was one of the things I was going to talk about today. The Russians have, in a euphemism that I use pretty commonly, hauled out a double-barrel shotgun loaded with buckshot, aimed it at their feet, and pulled both triggers. But I don't know how they're going to get out of it, very frankly. A couple of things have kind of conspired against them. And it's one of those fascinating things. I could make a case based on no evidence, purely on hypothesis, that the United States and the Saudis got together and decided to punish all of America's enemies. Because oil really went into a free fall when the Saudis said they're not going to reduce production. Actually, it was they were operating in their own best interest. They're basically trying to freeze out fracking by running the cost of oil low enough that it's unprofitable to pull oil out of the ground using fracking. But what's going on with the ruble is a little bit scary in one aspect, and that is that the Russians owe a lot of money to companies and even nations in Europe and to a lesser degree in the United States. And if their economy goes into meltdown, if the ruble goes into a complete meltdown, which happened the last time around in 1998, it will have an impact on world markets. There'll be a lot of value disappear. Now, while it won't directly affect the United States hugely, there are a lot of companies in Europe that will be hurting in a serious fashion. And Europe has already been hovering on the edge of a recession, and I can assure you that Russia is not helping them a bit, and the fall of the ruble means that the Russians are in a position where they really can't pay for what they're buying from Europe, which they need, a lot of things they need to buy from Europe, with rubles, and apparently the dollars have pretty much dried up. The article in Real Time Economics and Wall Street Journal today noted that in several of the major cities in Russia right now, a Russian nobody can buy dollars. The dollars are just not there. Russians, and I've mentioned this before, commonly keep, wealthy Russians at least, keep packs of $100 bills in safes because they remember what happened in 1998 when the ruble collapsed and had to be they had to start all over again. And I think that is a very real possibility at this point. The issue is that Russia has got two major things working against it right now. The first is they are spending money at a fairly high rate of speed on for the size of their economy on defense. One of Vladimir Putin's things that he's done that has made him very, very popular politically is a resuscitation of the Russian military. And while they are probably incapable of creating a military force that would be a threat to the United States, it isn't at all hard for them to create a military force that would be a threat to Europe, because Europe's military force has atrophied to the point of almost non-existence in many cases, in many areas. The Germans particularly have seen, and well as other countries, are basically limping along with an extremely weak military and some very old equipment. The Russians have seen an opportunity to do some things that they think are very, very important, which is a move into countries where there are Russian-speaking populations and take over the sections of the country where people speak Russian. Very frankly, I can tell you that I have some degree of understanding why they're doing that. One, they have a lot of problems in Russia across the board. And the problems in Russia have to do, and I've talked about this before, largely with demographics. The Russians just aren't having babies. And they're not having babies because a combination of communism and the economic collapse that followed the fall of communism and has really, really hurt their economic future. And having a child is expensive. Children are not encouraged or in any way forced or even culturally even do support their parents in Russia. The communist system there broke that family bond, just shattered the family bond. And as a result, very much like in the United States today, children are not as much an investment for the future of a family as they are just an out-and-out expense. In order to make ends meet, most Russians have both parents working, and for someone to take off enough time to have a child is financially really, really, really devastating in Russia. And it was already happening in the Soviet Union, but it's accelerated in Russia. They also have had a phenomenal brain drain, as anybody who has any, or not anybody, but many of the people who are educated and who anybody who can got out, and more people are continuing to get out. So they've got a shrinking population, they've got an aging population, they've got a lot of things wrong inside of Russia. So you've got a situation where Vladimir Putin wants to stay in power because he wants to do some things, and he has to keep the Russians happy. And the way you keep the Russians happy is you generate, and this is one of the grand things that happens in politics, when everything is falling apart internally, you generate an external enemy and you fight him. And his approval ratings in Russia are phenomenal. He is in no danger of being overthrown. He is phenomenally popular because he's standing up to the United States. He's standing up to the evil Ukrainians, as he calls it. By the way, in Russian, I've gone and read English language publications that come out of Russia that are controlled by the Russians, much the way the Soviets used to, but don't look like they are. And you would think that based on the reading there, which is translated from Russian, you would conclude that the Ukrainians are Nazis, that the National Socialist Party has taken over in Ukraine, and they're all neo-Nazis, and they were torturing Russian-speaking people, and that's just the game they're playing. Now, what has that got to do with it? Vladimir Putin has got to stay in that position to stay in power. If he were to back down, if he were to pull troops out of Ukraine, which he needs to do to keep the ruble from collapsing, if he were to turn Crimea back over to Ukraine rather than having annexed it as he did, the Russian people would probably throw him out of office. So he's in a position where the people who elected him have supported him fully in doing exactly what he did. The Russians feel very, very, very persecuted. I don't know how well you followed this or remember it, but obviously the world was shocked this last week when a school full of children was massacred in Pakistan. But you may remember a few years ago that happened in Russia. And the fact that their president is willing to send troops someplace to protect Russian-speaking people and identify confirm the Russian paranoia. The Russians are basically, there are people that feel like they're persecuted. They have a persecution complex, a huge one in their nation, which is very, very, very normal given their history. They have been invaded about once a generation by somebody as far back as their history goes. And whoever invaded them basically has run over their country and the country has collapsed. And somebody has picked it up and moved on. And the way the Russians deal with that is by annexing the nations around them to give them a buffer zone. They have a very different worldview than ours. Do I think that it was a good idea for them to annex Crimea and invade the three countries they've invaded and occupied now, portions of those countries? No. I think the risks in doing that and the potential damage to them for doing that is far greater than any benefit they could possibly get. But they have a point, and that is, the United States has done it on several occasions. We don't necessarily occupy, but for instance, in Kosovo, we went in and took a chunk of a nation, separated it out, and made it a separate nation that is basically allied with the West and with NATO. We have invaded Panama. We invaded Grenada when we didn't like the governments there. And that's Putin's justification. But the point is, we did it from a position of power. We got out afterwards, and we at least received some kind of tacit approval from international organizations before we did it. Needless to say, the Russians aren't interested in that, and so they've just done it. They believe in taking, and Putin particularly believes in just taking action. So we've got sanctions against Russia right now that are moderately severe, that basically restrict their access to dollars. And we've cut their banking system off from both the euro and from dollars. Now, that they probably could have survived. But the primary dollar source for an otherwise invalid Russian economy is the sale of oil. And the sale of oil, when they started their relatively aggressive behavior, was at $120 a barrel. It's now, the kind of oil they sell is probably selling for about 40-some dollars a barrel, $40 to $50 a barrel. And because where they produce the oil is mainly in the Siberian area, where the weather is less than pleasant and it is a long ways from anywhere else, the price of getting their oil out of the ground and getting it to some place where it could be sold exceeds the price they are receiving for oil right now. So they have to sell oil to get money, but with each barrel they sell, they're losing money. And that is a really, really, really bad position to be in. Now, if the sanctions weren't there, the International Monetary Fund could go in and assist them. Not that they probably would listen very much, but they would have the ability to go in and assist the Russians. And probably the Federal Reserve of the United States would assist in shoring up their banks if those sanctions weren't there. Now, why would we assist in shoring up the banks? So would the European Central Bank. Because there's so much money owed to the Western world from Russia, it is not really in our best interest to see the ruble collapse. However, given Russia's aggressive tendencies recently, seeing them restricted financially is probably considered a plus politically. Here's the danger. The danger is if the Russian people make a run on their banks, and very frankly, they're not very far from it right now. They are teetering on the edge of getting their rubles out before the system melts down. The interest rates in Russia right now, set by the Russian Central Bank, you know, like interest rates in the United States set by the Federal Reserve, are zero to 0.25, which if you don't think that that's true, go to the bank and see how much interest you get on a deposit. In Russia, that same type of interest rate is now 17%, which, by the way, is really, really, really bad fiscal policy. Why did they raise the rate to 17%? In the hope of getting people to loan money to their central bank at 17% interest, to loan rubles. Now, when a ruble has fallen 50%, a 17% interest rate isn't a lot of help. And anyone who loaned money to the Russians right now is violating sanctions that have been imposed by the United States and the European Union. And that basically means Latin American countries, African countries, possibly China might, but China doesn't seem to be particularly interested in doing that. So the Russians are, as the euphemism goes, between a rock and a hard place, and I don't frankly see how the heck they're going to get out of it. I don't think politically or by his nature, Putin is going to back out of Crimea, certainly not Crimea, because he's declared, he just reiterated that in his end-of-year address, that Crimea is part of Russia. In that same address, he said Ukraine is historically part of Russia and belongs to be part of Russia, which is a pretty strong signal and got a standing ovation that his intent is to take the entire nation of Ukraine. Now, whether he'll do that or not, I don't know. But he is in a position right now where he's facing a potential collapse of the total economy, a collapse of the nation state of Russia. And one of the things that dictators do, and sometimes elected officials do, when they're facing an internal collapse, is slap currency controls on and go to war. Germany entered World War II basically over those issues. They began to invade nation states around them because of the really, really harsh sanctions that were put on them following World War I. I mean, across the board, you see the studies that have been done on that, and it really boiled down to the fact that the Germans elected, and it's a very important point to note, that they elected, democratically elected, Adolf Hitler. Democracy chose Adolf Hitler. And Hitler, faced with a collapsing economy, I don't know if you remember from your, if you took those classes, I don't know that they even give them anymore, where the pictures of the Germans pushing wheelbarrows full of 1,000 mark bills to go buy a loaf of bread. They had a collapse of their currency. They had a collapse of their economy. People were literally starving and freezing to death. If Russia gets to that point, I would not be at all surprised to see Vladimir Putin declare himself dictator and start invading countries. And why would he do that? Very frankly, because he doesn't think anybody will do anything about it. If he's convinced, and I think he has good cause to be convinced, that the that NATO will do nothing if he invades countries, as long as he has the excuse that there's Russian speakers there, which, by the way, was exactly the same excuse that Hitler used until he invaded Poland. And Poland, he invaded one too many countries because Poland had a treaty with Great Britain and with France. He didn't think because the Great Britain and France had not done anything and because the militaries were weak across Europe, Hitler was of the opinion that if he trumped up an invasion of Poland and he did it, that the West would make a lot of noise and do nothing. And when France and Great Britain declared war on Germany, he just saw this as an opportunity to crush him because, frankly, they didn't have anything that could stand against him, and we saw that happen very, very quickly. The entry of the United States into the war was the thing that tipped the balance against Germany and, of course, Japan, who started it. Now, can we be repeating that same cycle? Absolutely. The United States' official position right now is we won't get involved in Ukraine. We will not send troops to Ukraine because we have a revulsion right now in the United States against putting boots on the ground someplace unless we have a solid treaty or some absolute requirement to do so. The question is whether we defend NATO if Russia, for instance, went into Latvia or some country that we had barely heard of or understood. It's next to Russia and it's not next to us, and we don't feel a threat. There's a serious question as to whether the United States would do anything about it. Now, what's all that got to do with the ruble? The ruble's in free fall because of a combination of a collapse in oil prices. Well, it starts with a mismanagement of an economy that's spending more money on defense than it should be. It moves on to the fact that sanctions were already hurting them. And it ends with the issue that being an export-dominated, particularly a natural resources export-dominated socioeconomic system, is incredibly dangerous. This is one of the things that economists have written great books on. It's called the Dutch curse, for whatever it's worth, because the Dutch were in a position of doing that one time, and their economy basically collapsed. That was many, 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 many years ago, but still it happened, and it's been studied. And one of the things that is, it's a very, very dangerous thing to be export dependent, heavily export dependent. The reason is that events outside of the control of the people who are dependent upon it, in other words, the China recognizes their danger, the dangerous position they're in, by being export dependent. But China is not in a terribly dangerous position because they're not exporting raw materials. Saudi Arabia exports raw materials. Iran lives off the export of oil. And Iran is in deep trouble right now, as is Venezuela. So this will be an interesting challenge as we move forward, and it's something to watch. It's one of the reasons that the markets dropped when we had this precipitous drop of oil. It's the market's recovery has been a little bit of a wake up that oil prices dropping in the United States may have some localized damage that it's done or will do. But overall, it's putting a lot more money in the pockets of people who tend to spend their money relatively quickly, which is the middle class, the lower two-thirds economically of the people in the United States, the lower two-thirds of income recipients in the United States. A drop in the price of gasoline puts more money in their pockets that they can spend somewhere else where there's a higher profit margin. So it's basically good for the United States economy. The Russian ruble collapse would probably put Europe into a recession, which could hurt us. It possibly could cause Russia to react aggressively. Last time around, when the Russian ruble collapsed, we had a pretty healthy collapse in the market. 1998, we had, in effect, a severe correction. And I think if the Russians today or next week started a run on their banks, which they're right on the edge of doing right now, and as a result, the price of the ruble collapsed to nothing, which it's headed towards right now, we could get a major market correction, a panic. How long would it last? Probably about as long as the one as 1998 did, which is between 12 and 18 months at most. It was over with relatively quickly, as this type of panic is, because the United States economy will have a very minor hit from a collapse of Russia. Russia's total GDP is not greatly different right now from that of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It was higher. It was up around the size of Texas. But now it's back down to the point where it's roughly the same output as the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But that doesn't mean people won't panic. People love to panic over things like this. People tend to be wildly exuberant on the upside and wildly exuberant on the downside. So that's a long story to do with the issues surrounding the ruble. We're going to make a break for commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is out of town this weekend. We only got 1 hour, so if you've got some calls or any questions about what's going on economically or likely to happen economically or to do with investing, you're certainly welcome to give us a call, 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. I said us, meaning me. Let's look at the markets for just a second. We had about a 5% drop in the market the last couple of weeks, and the standard procedure occurred. As the market went down, more and more money was pulled out of equity mutual funds, so that we had the maximum outflow from equity mutual funds dead at the bottom of this minor semi-correction we just had. Is that ever typical behavior? And of course, what happened this week is the market was up 3%, and it's almost back up to where it was before it started down again. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed out at 17,804. S&P 500 at 2,070. And what it amounted to, and we said this on the radio programs the last several weeks, is the market drop was in reaction to the fact that oil prices were falling. That is got to be one of the prime examples of the short-term irrationality of the stock market. And when I say short-term, I mean anything under several years. The stock market acts like it is insane. Over the long term, it's both predictable and eminently reasonable. If you know the type of reason and predictability to use, what is not predictable is what's going to happen in the short term. As I said, the market was up 3%, despite the fact it is faced with a bigger risk now than when it went down. The collapse of the Russian ruble and the collapse of the Russian economy could lead to some, very unpredictable results. So the market was up 3%. And it was up 3% because Janet Yellen used a term, patient, which you gotta really wonder about that herd mentality of the people running around on Wall Street. And if you ever see them on TV, you can see they look like they're crazy. They are. But collectively, somehow it all works out. Let's look at a little longer term here, though. For the last 52 weeks, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 9.76%, up 7.41% year to date. Now, unless you were 100% invested in stocks in your portfolio, you probably didn't see that much gain in your portfolio this year. And that's okay. And if you are 100% invested in stocks, you might want to re-examine your philosophy. The S&P 500 year-to-date up about 12%. The Barron's 400, which is a fairly conservative, large value set of stocks, which just shows up every time I look in here, which, by the way, over the last week was up 3.37, more than the Dow, more than the, well, almost as much as the S&P 500, but its year-to-date gain is only 5.38%. So if you look at your portfolio and you're not seeing double-digit returns, don't be too terribly surprised. There's a reality here, and that is that this is either long-term or it doesn't work. There is something that I found you can learn from in what's happened in the markets over the last year. The Philadelphia Gold Silver Exchange Index notes that for the 52-week, for this year to disco, year to date, that's what we're using before, gold slash silver, which is an index, is down about 18%. And I want you to remember, if you've seen, if you watch Fox or someplace where there's a lot of gold advertisements, all the predictions that gold at this point would be $2,000 an ounce. And if you bought gold, you're probably not real happy about the fact that it's probably, if you bought gold at the peak, which is obviously when the majority of gold was being purchased, the price fell about 50%. This is one of the things that you want to think about just a moment. During the financial crisis, gold fell. It was only as the recovery got underway that the price of gold went up. And you got to wonder, well, why did the price of gold go up? Well, there's a lot of reasons for it. But the bottom line to it is a lot of people were selling gold commercially. And there was a lot of fear, and people played to the fear. So a lot of people wound up buying gold. So the price went up. You can't fight the system, though. If we see a collapse in the ruble, you will probably not see a panic in the United States market. There's very little probability that gold will be a good place to be. And the reason is a lot of Russians hold a lot of gold. Gold, matter of fact, Russia is one of the largest gold producers in the world, and they're going to be selling gold wherever they can sell gold to get dollars. And when there's a lot of selling going on in gold, which there has been over the last 6 months or a year, when there's a lot of, that's why the price goes down, by the way. A lot of people are selling gold, and it's not the people in the United States who bought it as something that they wanted to have in case there was a financial panic or something, but the people who are selling gold are largely in Russia, and it is pushing the price of gold down. And the Russians, if the price of oil goes down, and it is, and it continues to go down, if the Russians want money, they're going to sell gold on the black market, in effect. But that, since gold can easily be sold on a non-regulated market, you're probably going to see the price of gold fall even further. That's one of the things that you might want to just be aware of. The small cap stocks, by the way, represented by the Russell 2000, year-to-date are only up 2.78%. The S&P Mid-Cap 400, which is the area that we like in equities, is up about 8%. So, year-to-date. And that's just the reality of the market as you look at it today. And I know that some people were kind of expecting a 10% return in the recent past or a 12% return, and I think we got our mindset back in the 1990s, if you think that's true. When the other thing, of course, that came up this week is, and I mentioned that in passing, is the Federal Reserve had a meeting, and they published their minutes, and they discussed it, and they said, and so the various members of the Federal Reserve who were in the meeting have made speeches since then, and it looks like interest rates are going to be, based on what they're discussing right now, rising around June or so. Now, will they really? I don't know. If the price of oil stays low and the Russian economy continues to collapse and the trends that we see going on right now continue to go on, we might not see interest rates rise until really late like next year, somewhere around October. I think at some point, though, in 2015, we're going to see interest rates start up a little bit and continue into 2016, simply because all of the indicators that we follow at the Personal Wealth Coach suggest that the United States economy is going to do better next year than it did in 2014. And by 2016, it still looks very much like the United States economy will finally get to something approaching a full recovery. In many aspects, it already is recovered, but in other aspects, it isn't. Another effect, obviously, that's going on right there. We've discussed this at great length, and it's one of those things that sometimes irritates the more conservative side of things. But it's dangerous economically when you have a huge disparity between the upper and lower income people, and we're working on the largest disparity right now since the 1920s. Meaning that people in the upper small percentage of the economy, and certainly the upper half of the economy, are doing relatively well and actually seeing either stable or increasing real income. The reverse is true for about 50% of the people in the United States. They're actually seeing a decline in income. Is this an abnormal situation? No. Is it potentially dangerous? Yes. And it's something that we have to really be aware of, because the people in the upper half make their money from selling things, manufacturing and selling things. And it's mostly people in the bottom half who buy them. And that's one of the things we have to be really, really aware of is, if we get too much wealth concentration in the high income side of the economy, the people in the low income side won't be able to keep buying things, and things tend to get bad from there. I'm not in any way in favor of wealth distribution, redistribution. That doesn't work. What I'm saying is, we need to look at our institutions. And very frankly, the big differential between the top and between making a lot of money right now and being well off financially and not being well off financially is in education. One of the main reasons that the housing industry has not been hiring people, and that's where a lot of the lower half previously have had jobs that don't have jobs today, or they're doing something else other than building houses, is because of a deadly combination of high student loans, which is eating up a lot of income of new families in the United States, and educations that, while they have a college degree associated with them, will not get a person a job. What can we do about this? Well, my recommendation is that we get a little smarter. And we recognize that if somebody is going to go to college and they're going to borrow money, or if you as a parent or grandparent are going to finance a college education in some way, that it's important that that college education be oriented on something that has the potential for creating employment. And I'm seeing us move in that direction, but unfortunately, the way I see us moving in that direction is a reflection of everything else that's going on. It's the upper half, the upper 20% of students in high schools are rapidly focusing on educations that have a high potential to provide them with income in the future. And the further down the academic and income level we go and we look at students, the more likely they are to be doing something or in education that is easy, expensive, they're borrowing the money to do it, and unlikely to provide them with a job. And that's going to be a drain on the economy until we straighten this out. Very frankly, one of the if you've listened to me any length of time, one of the things that I am firmly an advocate of is a form of economics called New Institutional Economics that was one of the main founders was Douglas North. And there's a book that anyone who really wants to understand what's going on in the economy, both world and locally and across the board, would really do you good to read Structure and Change in Economic History by Douglas North. That's one of the books he wrote, but it is one that is relatively easy to read. I say relatively because there's no math in it. It does require you to think really, really hard, and so it'll take a while to complete the book. It's not light reading. But he wrote a book. He got the Nobel Prize for that. That's the centerpiece of the books he got the Nobel Prize for in 1993 in economics. And he describes the fact that institutions make up socioeconomic systems like the United States, major institutions. In the public school system right now and the higher education system are major institutions that are very, very weak. And why are they weak? Very frankly, because they're disconnected from commerce. They're disconnected from the capitalist system. You can get a government loan, a guaranteed loan, and borrow so much money that it will be nearly impossible to pay it back at any interest rate, and at the same time be pursuing a degree that has little or no chance of ever getting a job. No free enterprise capitalist system would support that, but the government does. The systems that we have in place under a series of presidents have resulted in the public school system being focused into some areas that are not particularly productive for children. In many school systems, the advanced AP honors and even the middle stream of education has been severely neglected because of the No Child Left Behind program, where we spend a tremendous amount of money educating people to make them minimally functional in society. And we have a call on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering if a person was concerned about their financial accounts being hacked or identity theft, if you held your stock certificates in a safe deposit box, would you still be vulnerable to being hacked, or would that be a safe way to keep your finances from being screwed over by somebody?
It isn't a safe way, because I personally have run into situations where people have lost their key to their safety deposit box, or they die. People do that, or they become incapacitated, and it takes an act of God and three letters from your congressman to get into that safety deposit box. I've had cases where people have put their certificates in their safety deposit box and their widow finally gets them out after years and finds out that many of the companies that those certificates represent are bankrupt. It is far safer to have your securities in a reputable firm's custody. Yeah, at our firm we use Pershing. There are certainly others out there because, for starters, you have a federally chartered and backed system that will ensure the stocks, bonds, and money in your account up to $500,000. Some of the securities firms go much higher. That's $500,000 per account. And up to, I think, 200, I don't know whether it's 100, 100,000, yeah, I think it's still 100,000 of that can be cash. And so if something happens and you, because of malfeasance or collapse or anything else, you have your stocks stolen from your account, because the brokerage firm was hacked, for example, the brokerage firm is required to replace them. And if the brokerage firm goes under because it can't replace them, then there is a federal agency that steps in and will replace those securities.
And what would you need to prove that you had these?
A statement.
That's it.
That's it. And it's not at all hard to prove that, by the way. You do get either an electronic or an actual statement. It's a very secure system. And that's why you've never heard of anybody having their massive stock account fraud. The other thing is the Securities and Exchange Commission has a very, 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 very high standard for security around securities accounts. We are, because we're an investment advisory firm regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, we have to hold to that standard. And we are held to the NSA, given enough time, could probably break into our system. But no hacker is going to. I'm quite confident of that. The statement, I don't remember who by, but some authority statement that said 95% of the corporations in the United States have a security that isn't any better than Sony's. Well, 5% do, and that 5% are almost all financial.
I ask is you watch CNBC and you get these talking heads on there and they start talking about China or take North Korea or something like that just coming in and destroying our financial system by whatever they do in this cloud business.
Well, there are vulnerabilities there. And they could shut down the internet by just overloading it, but they couldn't keep it shut down. And that would be an act of war. We've actually got that set up that way. The type of things that these people are describing have officially been designated in the United States by law as an act of war. And Iraq found out that when you do something that the United States has designated as an act of war, it has a tendency to shorten the lifespan of whoever leads that country. So there's really very little or no risk in that area. Because literally an attack on our infrastructure would clearly be considered an act of war. And federal agencies have been, particularly since 9/11, have been really, really, really hard on checking and making sure that the, particularly the Department of Homeland Security, making sure that cybersecurity is in place around vital structures. That doesn't mean that they don't have the right to go to Sony or General Motors or anybody else and make them do it. So sometimes they don't. But believe me, the federally regulated part of our system in the United States is pretty thoroughly protected right now. Okay?
Okie dokie. Thank you.
Okay. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got one more commercial to run, and we're going to be almost out of time at that point, so we're going to run it, and we'll be right back. And we're back with the Personal Wealth Coach. Just got less than a minute left. If you would like to contact us off the air, you can reach us. We have a voicemail on the weekend, 947-1111. or 1-800-914-7526. That's 1-800-914-PLAN. During the week, of course, you can call those numbers and there'll be somebody there to answer the telephone. If you had something that you wanted to say and you wanted to say it by email, you can certainly send me an email at jeff@tpwc.com, or you can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you can leave a message there, or you can listen to podcasts and
your
further deteriorate your brain. This
Texas
has been the Personal Wealth
News
Coach.
Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.